Welcome to a special bonus episode of Hot Off the Wire. In this edition of our daily news program, we feature a selection of stories covering a variety of topics. I'm Terry Lipschitz, managing editor of the National Newsroom at Lee Enterprises and your curator of news. Be sure to subscribe to Hot Off the Wire through Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss daily news updates. And now, those stories from the Associated Press.
After receiving a year's worth of rain in October and experiencing one of the wettest Novembers on record, Death Valley in California is teeming with life and carpets of gold and a rare blossoming of wildflowers known as a super bloom. Ginger Jensen says she took a side trip.
Yeah, it's really beautiful with the mountains in the background and seeing all the flowers just, you know, out in the open.
Sightseer Michael Baker says,
it's only once every 10 or 50 years or whatever, so it's great to be able to be here, and it's a rare opportunity.
Tiffany Pereira with the Desert Research Institute says the flower species can withstand decades of drought conditions.
So there might be species that they haven't come up in 10 years, but those seeds are still in the ground living.
Depending on the weather, the show should continue through mid to late March, with wildflowers at higher elevations blooming into June.
Death Valley National Park is famous as the hottest place on Earth, but right now it's experiencing a rare super bloom when just the right conditions trigger an explosion of wildflowers that blanket the desert floor.
We are experiencing a super bloom.
Park Ranger Matthew Lamar says this year's bloom is the best the California park has seen since 2016.
It's a pretty rare event, happens once a decade, and so the wildflowers are just well above average. And so this landscape that sometimes people think of as desolate or devoid of life is coming alive.
It's beautiful.
Ginger Jensen and Michael Baker are among the visitors who made a special trip.
The mountains in the background and seeing all the flowers.
It's only once every 10 or 50 years or whatever, so it's great to be able to be here.
Tiffany Pereira studies rare plant ecology.
A lot of desert gold, the big sunflowers that are coming up, gold globe mallow, pretty orange cups.
Visitors are asked to stick to the trails to avoid trampling the flowers and hungry sphinx moth caterpillars. I'm Jennifer King.
When COVID wrought havoc in early 2020, today's youngest school children were infants or not yet born. Now, in their early school years, researchers are beginning to see how the pandemic years have shaped their education. First and second graders continue to perform worse than their pre-pandemic counterparts on math and reading tests. That's according to a report published Tuesday by the Education Assessment and Research Group, NWEA. But while math scores have inched up every year, reading scores remain stagnant. I'm Julie Walker.
The military says a KC-135 refueling plane supporting operations against Iran crashed in Iraq. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Dan Kane says all six crew members were killed.
The incident occurred over friendly territory in western Iraq while the crew was on a combat mission. And again, was not the result, as CENTCOM has said, was not the result of hostile or friendly fire.
There was another plane involved. It landed safely. This is the fourth publicly acknowledged aircraft to crash in the war against Iran. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth was asked about the crash.
American heroes, all of them. And as I have with all of them, as we have, we will greet those heroes at Dover. And their sacrifice will only recommit us to the resolve of this mission.
The crash brings the U.S. death toll in Operation Epic Fury to at least 13 service members, seven of whom were killed in combat. The KC-135 Stratotanker is used to refuel other planes in midair. In Iran, a large explosion rocked an area in Tehran where thousands were gathered for a state-organized rally. People were calling for the demise of Israel. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says Iranian leaders are on the defensive.
Desperate and hiding, they've gone underground, cowering. That's what rats do. We know the new so-called not-so-supreme leader is wounded and likely disfigured.
He did not provide any evidence. Iran has continued to launch widespread missile and drone attacks and has effectively closed the Strait of Hormuz, a vital oil passageway. Hegseth is downplaying it.
And as the world is seeing, they are exercising sheer desperation in the Straits of Hormuz. Something we're dealing with, we have been dealing with it, and don't need to worry about it.
Meantime, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz is calling for what he called a convincing plan on how to end the war. More is being learned about a man who was killed after attacking a Michigan synagogue. Officials say Ayman Mohammed Ghazali lost four family members in an Israeli airstrike in Lebanon last week. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer spoke of the need to tone down the rhetoric.
People like the person that attacked this community yesterday get fomented by rhetoric that they see online and that they see on television and they hear on the radio. It radicalizes people. And it endangers our fellow Michiganders.
106 children and more than 30 staff were at the synagogue at the time of the attack. None were injured. Michigan Democratic Senator Alyssa Slotkin credited responders.
If they had not all done their jobs almost perfectly, we would be talking about an immense tragedy here today with children gone.
Ghazali was a U.S. citizen. I'm Ed Donahue.
A key inflation gauge has increased. The Commerce Department says prices increased nearly 3% in January compared to a year earlier, the latest sign that prices were elevated even before the Iran war started. Excluding the volatile food and energy categories, which the Federal Reserve pays close attention to, core prices increased just over 3%, the highest in nearly 2 years. Since the start of the Iran war, oil prices have soared more than 40%. And AAA says gas prices have jumped to $3.60 a gallon from just under $3 a month earlier. Economists think those figures will likely cause inflation to spike in March and possibly April. A surprisingly sluggish economic end to 2025. The Commerce Department says the U.S. economy, which was hobbled by last fall's 43-day government shutdown, grew at an annual rate of 0.7% in the fourth quarter. That's half the original estimate. Economists had expected the revision to go the other way and show stronger fourth quarter growth. Federal government spending and investment, which were clobbered by the shutdown, plunged by nearly 17%. Knocking more than a percentage point off fourth quarter growth. Mike Hemp in Washington.
Law enforcement officials say the number on the gun used in the fatal Old Dominion shooting was obliterated. A law enforcement official says the shooter who opened fire in a classroom at Virginia's Old Dominion University in an attack is being investigated as an act of terrorism. The obliterated serial number could complicate efforts to determine how a man with a felony obtained a firearm. The official says investigators will try to resurface the number in order to trace the gun. The FBI identified the shooter as Muhammad Baylor Jallo, a former Army National Guard member who pleaded guilty in 2016 to attempting to aid the Islamic State. FBI officials said ROTC students subdued and killed Jallo to stop the shooting. I'm Haya Pinjwani.
About 40 million Americans get their water from private wells, and they're particularly vulnerable to harmful chemicals known to scientists as PFAS. These forever chemicals are uniquely able to repel stains and moisture to withstand heat, which makes them essential for products from waterproof shoes to firefighting foam.
And they've been linked by either long-term exposure to low amounts or very high amounts with a shorter exposure to everything from low birth weight in kids to a resistance to how effective vaccines can be to certain kinds of cancers as well. And the problem with these is that they don't go away in the environment and they can build up in the human body.
Hi, I'm Haya Panjwani. On this episode of The Story Behind the AP Story, we speak to three reporters who looked into how PFAS chemicals have been affecting towns in America and what it means for the future generations of the people who live there.
I'm Helen Wiefering.
I'm Michael Phyllis.
I'm Jason Dearen.
PFAS isn't just an umbrella term for thousands of different synthetic man-made chemicals. They're used in all sorts of consumer products because they resist water, grease, heat, and that kind of same factor that makes them so good at being water resistors, grease resistors, also makes them really persistent in the environment. They've been used since like the 50s, but only in the past couple of decades have scientists and environmental regulators started to come to terms with the scope of the pollution. I don't think any of us here knew that Dalton, Georgia, this small town in northwest Georgia, is kind of a huge center of carpet production. They call themselves the carpet capital of the world. There are many, many carpet mills located there and in the region. They use PFAS and have since the 1970s mostly for stain and soil resistance on the carpets. So they spray them during the dyeing process or in other stages of carpet manufacturing. And what happens is they create wastewater runoff from that dyeing process that contains PFAS that either went, you know, directly into local creeks when there were spills, or more commonly, it went into drains in the dye houses, down through the sewer pipes to the local utility. The local utility would treat that wastewater, but the treatment system, of course, didn't have any sort of PFAS filtering or anything like that. So the PFAS passed through and then into the local river that people use for drinking water. And they also sprayed this wastewater on like 9,000 acres of forested land right on the river, and so it would seep down through the soil and back into the river. So most of this wastewater ended up back in the river, and this river is a source of drinking water for hundreds of thousands of people, not only in Georgia, but downstream through Alabama.
We did pointing on a lot of ideas, circulated some things that didn't quite work out, and we realized that there's 40 million people on private wells in the U.S., and there's just were not a lot of rules that actually helped them in many states. So we dove into that a little bit more and realized that we had a story there.
The federal government has recently required drinking water that's provided by public utilities to be tested for PFAS. But the same regulations don't apply to private wells. Many rural communities don't have access to main water lines or utility water. And so they essentially tap their water from the groundwater where they live. And that groundwater can be contaminated by PFAS use by industries nearby. And there's no federal authority checking that water source. There's a lot of challenges to testing private wells. Largely, it would be very expensive and very time intensive for any federal regulations to apply to private wells. And a lot of people on private water do value just this independence they have, being able to source their own water from their land and not have to pay, a water bill. But what's happening now is just PFAS is really becoming this unprecedented chemical that is so widely used in estimates say, you know, about half of all drinking water could have PFAS in it. And it's really expensive to test for and treat, and very difficult to actually get your water free of these chemicals. So by not having any testing mandates, there's this huge burden that's being placed on homeowners who have private water.
The EPA has taken some steps federally to deal with PFAS, and there's been a growing understanding that this is a threat that the federal government has to think about and act on. The biggest thing that they've done is they've passed limits on how much PFAS can be in drinking water. And they set it at very low amounts, 4 parts per trillion. The comparative that we have in the story on that is it's about or less than 1 drop of water in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. There's also rules about in the most contaminated spots called Superfund sites, that some of these PFAS chemicals can be part of the kind of forced cleanup of those sites as well. The problem is that for private wells, there's a big gap. Because the drinking water standards don't apply to private wells, you gotta rely on states to set their own rules, and that usually means how much they're going to help private well owners once there's an issue. So we found that there's a big patchwork of states. Many states don't really actively look for contamination in private wells, so people can go a long time without knowing there's a problem. Other states don't provide much help for people that have an issue to pay for expensive treatment or dig a new well or hook up to a municipal drinking water system that everybody can know is safe.
In general, the nation's system of chemical regulation is really slow to respond and kind of favors the chemical makers over, you know, kind of like banning a chemical quickly, right? So oftentimes EPA needs 7 years under the law, the way it was when PFAS kind of started emerging as a problem, to study a chemical to even find out if it's a problem or poses some sort of threat. And during those 7 years, you know, even if there's some indication it could cause health problems or is an environmental threat, industry can keep using them. There's no kind of curb on that. And so, and given the fact that PFAS is an umbrella term for, you know, 15,000-ish type chemicals, it takes 7 years for each one for EPA to be able to kind of make rules, right? And so industry can always really easily stay out in front of regulation by just changing a molecule or changing something that keeps the, you know, kind of effectiveness of the product for industry, but changes it enough that it's not covered by whatever regulations are in that very slow pipeline.
We found that, for example, in Wisconsin, the town we reported on, which has huge amounts of PFAS in its drinking water and everyone is on private wells, that location was only discovered as a problem because Wisconsin undertook a statewide effort to test 450 wells equally distributed across the state. And they did not previously realize that the town of Stella had exorbitant amounts of PFAS in the water. But then you take a state like Georgia, where the carpet industry, as Jason was talking about, has used PFAS for decades. There's very little testing of private wells for PFAS there. The state does not offer testing, and the only area we're aware of where wells have been tested for PFAS and where well owners can get help with it if they find chemicals in their water is in a small town that reached a court agreement over a legal dispute.
Seeing the effect of this in Stella, Wisconsin was really important for my overall reporting of this story. It's a smaller town, I think roughly 600 people, northern Wisconsin, rural area, but a place where you could easily see why you'd want to live there. There's houses that ring very nice lakes that people would swim and fish in. People hunted there all the time, and you ended up seeing extremely high levels of PFAS in private wells that made people concerned about what it was going to mean for their kids, who had consumed that water for years. There were warnings about the hunting not being safe anymore, nor the fishing in the same way that it used to be, and concerns that because this had been spread on farm fields in a bunch of the town, that effectively it was everywhere. And it was not unclear at all for a lot of the people that were thinking hard about this, about how it was going to ever really feel normal again, or how much could actually be restored once you have a problem that's so widespread.
Thanks for listening to the story behind the AP story. For more on the story, visit apnews.com. For previous episodes of the story behind the AP story, visit the AP News YouTube channel, our website, or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is truly one sly fox who made his way from England to the U.S. as a stowaway on a cargo ship. The roughly two-year-old male red fox, who weighs about 11 pounds, is now at the Bronx Zoo, seemingly living his best life, according to Keith Lovett, the zoo's director of animal programs.
We will make sure that this animal has a very good permanent home, whether it's here at the zoo or some other type of facility.
It's not clear how the fox got on the ship full of automobiles, where he spent 2 weeks traveling the high seas, but Lovett jokes he's got cousins here.
It is a typical red fox. If you're lucky enough to see one in the wild, you know, they are a, you know, attractive species. They have that red color to them, but they are a very common species both here in the United States and in Europe.
Lovett says all things considered, the animal has adjusted pretty well at the zoo where he's their first red fox. Julie Walker, New York.
The National Museum of African American History and Culture is removing a rare slave ship timber from its Slavery and Freedom exhibit and sending it back to South Africa. Shanita Brackett, acting director.
It carries within it the story of more than 500 captive Africans and the more than half of the enslaved people who tragically perished in the turbulent waters.
The timber comes from a Portuguese ship that sank off the coast of South Africa in 1794.
You feel the darkness in the room. You feel the claustrophobia, all of the people around you. It is not hard to imagine.
Visitor Christina Hernandez.
These are things that another human being did to another human being, and this makes it real.
Visitors have until March 22nd to see the timber. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Commuters who post on social media during warm months to complain about hot subway systems in major cities should feel vindicated. New research says they are not alone. Northwestern University researchers analyzed more than 85,000 social posts between 2008 and 2024 for keywords relating to feelings of high temperatures. Assistant professor at Northwestern University, Georgia Chinazzo, says,
"We saw that there was a correlation between the air temperature and the posts about the thermal discomfort."
They found that a 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in outdoor temperature caused a 10% increase in complaints in Boston, 12% in New York, and 27% in London. Chinazzo says solutions are available.
Installing fans and operating fans, or having more of a cooling operation in specific time of the day rather than having a cooling all day.
I'm Haya Pinjwani.
All but two of Austria's 96 glaciers have retreated over the last 2 years, monitors in the Alpine country say, adding the dramatic development highlights the impact of climate change. The latest report from the Austrian Alpine Club shows the Alperna Ferna in the western Tyrol region and one in Salzburg to the east are facing the greatest loss. In the report covering 2024, the club adds the disintegration of the glacier tongue is also progressing at the Pasteurs, Austria's largest glacier, making the consequences of climate change very visible. The retreat of glaciers in Europe has vast implications for drinking water, power generation, agriculture, infrastructure, recreational activities, the alpine landscape, and more. At a news conference with French President Emmanuel Macron, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the US 30-day waiver on Russian oil sanctions amid the Iran war is not the right decision and won't help bring a stop to Russia's more than four-year-old invasion of Ukraine. Zelensky adds, this easing along by the US could provide Russia with about $10 billion for the war. This certainly does not help peace. I believe that lifting sanctions will, in any case, lead to a strengthening of Russia's position. The Treasury Department announced on Thursday a 30-day waiver on Russian oil sanctions. The step aims to free up Russian cargoes stranded at sea and ease supply shortages caused by the Iran war. Analysts say that spiraling oil prices due to Persian Gulf production blockages are benefiting the Russian economy. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
On this week's AP Religion Roundup, an armed man rams his vehicle into a Michigan synagogue during the latest uptick in violence.
There are no words. I was in complete and utter shock.
Allison Jacob's 18-month-old daughter attends daycare at the Temple Israel Synagogue in Bloomfield, Michigan. On Thursday, a man armed with a rifle drove his vehicle into the synagogue and was fatally shot by security.
The school handled it extremely well.
AP's Mike Hempen has more.
Authorities say the suspect in the Michigan synagogue attack was a naturalized citizen born in Lebanon. Federal officials say the armed man who rammed his vehicle into Temple Israel in West Bloomfield Township near Detroit has been identified as 41-year-old Ayman Mohammed Ghazali. He came to the U.S. in 2011 on an immigrant visa as the spouse of a U.S. citizen. The Department of Homeland Security says Ghazali was granted U.S. citizenship in 2016. The FBI special agent in charge, Jennifer Runyon, describes the attack as deeply disturbing and tragic.
We are leading the investigation right now as a targeted act of violence against the Jewish community.
Security officials fatally shot Ghazali after he drove through a hallway. I'm Mike Hempen.
Synagogues around the world have been on edge in ramping up security since the U.S. and Israel launched missile strikes against Iran on February 28th. Meanwhile, the FBI has warned that Iranian operatives may be planning drone attacks on targets in California. And two men brought explosives to a far-right protest outside the New York mayor's mansion on Saturday. Investigators allege they were inspired by the Islamic State group. Thursday's attack was the second at a house of worship in Michigan within the past year. Last September, a former Marine fatally shot four people at a church north of Detroit and set it ablaze. The FBI later said he was motivated by anti-religious beliefs against the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Walter Ratliff.
I'm Terry Lipschitz, thanking you for listening. Audio provided by the Associated Press. Be sure to subscribe to Hot Off the Wire on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode.